Let's
rock on.
Sure.
Okay, I'm Kathy Lass. I'm from St. Louis. I worked in Southampton County, Virginia, the home of Nat Turner.
I'm Margaret Roska, usually called Peggy. I worked in Bullock County, Alabama.
And you're from? Okay. Where are you from?
I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I'm Ken Long. I'm from California, Northern California now, Southern California when I was there. I was going to UCLA. We went to Bibb County, Georgia.
I'm Ray Nelson. I lived in Arkansas and came from Berkeley, and I was in Charleston, South Carolina.
I'm Selena Kiesecker. I did not work in that project. I was in migrant ministry in Colorado. My husband was in Madison, Florida.
With Scope?
With Scope, yes. Madison, Florida, with Scope.
We're just identifying ourselves.
Oh, that's not him.
That's
a different guy.
There's a good place.
Here you go.
It's all yours.
You could just identify yourself.
My name is Tom Rothschild. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I worked for Scope in Newberry County, South Carolina.
And we have one more person.
I'm Dale Petty. I'm the spouse of Janine Palms, who worked in Allendale, South Carolina.
We have Jason here.
I'm Jason Keck. I'm son of James Keck and Susan Turquie, who were in the movement, and I was born in 1972 out of that relationship. Thank you.
What we thought we would do next is have everybody talk for a few minutes to get the conversation going, talk uninterrupted for, what should we say, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes?
Yeah, we should time it, huh? We'll start out with 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Is that reasonable?
And then open it up for more general conversation. Kathy, you want to start?
Sure. Who's going to be the timekeeper? Selena? Can you? All right, good. And the subject is the effect it had on us. Well, 3 minutes. I can tell you about my biggest regret. My biggest regret, I mean, it was a profound experience. My biggest regret is that I didn't keep up more with some of the people that we stayed with. We were housed, there were four of us in the group, we were housed very graciously by many, many black families. And I had a particular connection with one woman who worked for a chemical company, and she would come home sometimes and cry at the kitchen table because no one spoke to her all day. She would go in and say good morning, and nobody would speak to her. It was a lovely family, and they had a little six-year-old girl. And as I say, she and I had a wonderful connection. I finally got around to finding their name, God bless the internet, and called there a couple of months ago. Unfortunately, she had passed away, which I really kicked myself for. But I did talk to her husband, and they've done quite well. He was building them a house when I was there, and their little girl is now an emergency room physician in D.C. And so we talked quite a lot. She went back to school, my friend Dolores, and got a master's degree in counseling and got a good job at the local high school and was able to say goodbye to this chemical company that had, I looked them up, they got kicked out of the country for polluting all everything they could. Anyway, that one of my biggest regrets is not keeping closer touch afterwards with people. So I feel like that's 3 minutes. Why I have one more minute.
How did it affect you?
How did it affect me? it affected me, and that's, I appreciated your comments so much, because it really was the most profound experience, I think, of my life. I'm now 73, but nobody knows and nobody gets it today. I'm still very emotional about it. So I regret maybe not talking about it more to people, or I just regret history as it rolls on. There are certain things that once they're accomplished are forgotten. So this has made me sad, but it's also made me very profoundly happy that there's so many of us left.
My name is Margaret Rosga. I work in Bullock County, Alabama. For me, the SCOPE project was the start of a lifetime of social justice activism. When I returned home, there was a school integration movement and a boycott of schools on the day that state funding is allotted. I taught in a freedom school. I went on to be involved in the Milwaukee campaign for fair housing legislation in 1967, 1968. I continue to work most recently with an arts organization called Arts at Large that does arts programming in schools. The students who work on their projects create a museum exhibit of whatever subject they're studying. The ones that I have been involved with have been civil rights related, one about the Milwaukee civil rights movement, and last year there was one about the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and we took a busload of Milwaukee students, mostly African American, to the reunion event in Jackson, Mississippi, and then did a civil rights tour of the South for the students on that bus. That was a transformative experience in much the same way. Well, who knows, because they're still young and have a lot of living to do. One of the things that I've noticed, and I'm really glad for this opportunity to talk about the impact on us, because some of the speakers have said things that make me think that we stopped our activism after the SCOPE project. And that's certainly not true for me. And one of the questions that I have in mind is, what other movements, what other actions, what other issues did you get involved with after you left SCOPE? Because I think that's all part of the legacy of SCOPE, that it prompted us to get involved in other things. And when I go home, I have school justice issues that I will continue to be involved in. So the question of what are you going to do from here is a non-question for me, because it just is continuing the things I've been involved in. Is that my 3 minutes?
Nope, you have 25 seconds more.
I did go back to visit the people in Bullock County several times. Actually, the first time I was back in Bullock County, I was too scared to talk to anybody. Being back in that, I wouldn't go down a country road. I was afraid to identify myself to anyone. Although it was like 35 years later, and who cared who I was? You know, who was this kind of middle-aged white woman? But I realized at that point that there had been a lot of post-traumatic stress, we would call it now. I think maybe a lot of us suffered from that without knowing a name for it.
Hi, I'm Ken Long. I can't say that I was a great deal more socially active after having gone to Macon, Georgia, but it was a big eye-opener for me to have gone. I did go the following year to Africa to be a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years. I have been back to see the host family that I had, because we called her Mama, a woman that was the matriarch of the house, and we really, she did become a second mother to many of us. But that was only the one time after having gone. I think the biggest impact on me was just the of course, the awareness of how things were in the South, certainly, but just being the awareness that skin color wasn't a very big deal and that people were just plain people and being comfortable with that. I was later a newspaper reporter, and I was working in rural California, and there was a minister, that black minister, that used to come to some of the city council meetings where I was a reporter, and on occasion we'd talk, and nothing big was going on, but after about a year, we were standing on the sidewalk talking about something, and I mentioned somehow about the civil rights experience, and he said, "I thought there was something different about you." There, in other words, there wasn't that little awkwardness that some white people have about being around a whole group of black people. There wasn't that little distance, and it was. I think that maybe that little thing might be the biggest impact on me. That they're just people. We're just people. How am I doing? Okay, I regret not having gone back and having done more with my experience. I don't know that I can express anything else as far as the impact on me.
I'd be happy to speak as a spouse.
Mm-hmm. Surely,
okay. Yeah. Please.
So my wife is Janine Palms. We're both from Ann Arbor, Michigan. She grew up in Detroit. And she went down to Allendale, South Carolina. And so, obviously, it had a really big impact on her, and therefore, it's had a big impact on me. But it was, as she said, it wasn't life changing. Her parents really brought her up in a sort of radical Catholic family, so it was part of the family. Her father had been on the Selma March before that, and then sent his two teenage kids down to the Scope Project in a family car. But as she said, it was a rite of passage for her. Just all the experiences really made a difference to her. And so since then, she's continued to be very active. She started a school, free school in Detroit, and she's been doing preschool for the last 25 years. And so now one of her preschoolers is on a presidential commission for disabled people in Washington. Another preschooler is our county commissioner and is now running for state representative for our county. So she shares her story constantly with these little kids and doing Rosa Parks days and all sort of actions to save trees that somebody's going to cut down. So she gets the kids involved in direct action at a kid level, and a lot of community organizing around these days, mostly local food and environmental issues.
And so, how has it changed you?
It's changed me because I grew up in a very conservative Nebraska family that was not political. I got pretty political in the war and resisted and was convicted of draft resistance. But I never had that long-term vision. So I've always been kind of scared and not audacious about my political activism. So it's inspiring to me to watch her continue having that energy to be politically active and have this sort of continual hope and vision. I get discouraged easily, but she has that vision, partly from her family, but I'm sure largely from Scope also, from the civil rights work. It just keeps her going. So, thank you.
Will you all hold? Just let me shift a little bit.
Keep this speaker going, too.
Those didn't need to be moved.
No.
That they picked up.
They'll pick up. We can put it in the middle of the table. It's designed to pick up.
Okay.
Are we live?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, they don't look like it.
Seems to give me the signal while we're ready. I'm Ray Nelson. I was raised in the Arkansas Delta and with a conventional set of mentality. And being involved with Scope was the evolution of a long process that finally resulted in activism. It was really my first experience with having been involved in anything. In the course, I was in Charleston, and in the course of our activities in Charleston, I was involved with the Catholic Diocese and some of their activities in the city of Charleston. And I had promised a sister there, who's the principal of the parochial school, that when the project was over, I would come to teach in that school with black children in Charleston. And I was unable to keep that promise. I was drafted in middle August and spent a while in the Navy. When I got out, I was back in Arkansas, and I was a history major, and I expected to teach and did, so I took my GI Bill and went down to Tulane and got my certificate. I felt like that promise to sister was still there in the back of my mind. So when I was ready to look for a job, I looked for those districts in Louisiana that were actively promoting integration. This was 1968. And I found one. I found one that had tried a very structured and deliberate plan to introduce us to cross-cultural teaching with sponsors and all of that sort of, a very structured and very systematic way of bringing about school integration. And so this is the system I chose to work in. It was a wonderful year for 1 year. And then one of the big cities hired our superintendent away, and we got a Klansman for the next superintendent who decided that he was going to make a wreck of the system, and did. And my sponsors told me as soon as this fellow became the superintendent, I was going to be a target. And it was true, because I had volunteered to teach black kids. And I liked it. I enjoyed the kids, and we had a good relationship, which didn't sit well with the authorities at that time. But there were several years of conflict involved in that, and it was I look back on it with considerable satisfaction. We brought a new activist leader to the teachers, the Black Teachers Organization. So instead of being just a blow off steam organization, it actually began to take action, opened ties to the Justice Department, and began to really do serious things. And my little part in this was they asked me to write a resolution. Right, something that we could express our grievances and propose a solution. And I put in this that the new president ought to be instructed to contact the Justice Department, tell them that we expected trouble, and we wanted the Justice Department to be involved with us, which he did. Which he did. And,
that's the most anxiety-producing, nerve-wracking year I think I ever spent in my life. But it was one of the that it produced some real results. We were able to bring the Justice Department into that in Concordia Parish in Louisiana, and set the course. Even though we were not able to get a new superintendent, but we were able to bring a degree of order that we were able to live with, able to undo some of the damage that the board had done. To the school system, like dividing boys and girls. We got rid of co-ed education thereafter. We sort of set the system back about 150 years. So we felt it was necessary to repair that damage, and we did, and we did. So we left a lot of, we did something that left a lot of permanent good behind us, we felt like, and not only just for that parish, but there were several other parishes that had done the same thing. They had divided boys and girls in there and just simply giving up on co-ed education, simply to avoid intermixing races. All of those parishes had to, because of the suit that we filed, had to reinstitute co-ed education in their parishes. So we felt like that promise to sister had some important implications. For me, a nervous breakdown, but we accomplished a great deal. at least as nearly as I ever came to that. But I think it set me on a course of activism that wasn't not necessarily intentional. It just seemed like the right thing to do. It wasn't designed to change the world. It was just that to do what seemed right in the situation as I found it.
Okay.
Tom Rothschild. I worked in Newberry County, South Carolina, and I think it's been helpful for me to hear the people who went first. It kind of jogged some things for me. As a concept, so to speak. It was simply a step and a natural progression in a family that was socially conscious, if not necessarily active. So it was just another step. I would say, in terms of its impact on me, it's hard to tease out all of those strands because it was not the only thing I did around those years. But I would say in some ways, and particularly personally, that summer and the summer 2 years later in Mississippi did affect me in that it moved from the idea of being in a relationship with an African-American community to the reality of it, and to the reality of what it was like in the rural South in those days, which was definitely something that someone who had grown up in New York City, I was not prepared for. And again, in a theoretical sense, I was prepared for it. So it wasn't like I ran away or I said I can't live like this or I want to go home or anything like that. But it was actually coming to grips and to understanding, maybe more than coming to grips with, understanding something about that reality as something lived rather than just an idea. So in that way, I guess it was kind of important for me. Beyond that, I'm terrible at keeping in touch with people, and I haven't been back until this week when I expect to go back. And so I can't say that beyond what I've described, which is certainly very important for me at least, there was something that I can point to and say that came out of this experience in particular. These days I'm primarily working as a Quaker with Native Americans. I'm a member of the Indian Affairs Committee, and I see that as a natural step and something appropriate for me to be doing at this point. So with that, I'll give it to Joe.
Hold up for a second. Hang on, Joe.
Are you still in New York?
Yes, I live in Brooklyn. In those days, I lived in Manhattan, although when I turned 18, because of the change in the law, which happened just at that time, I registered to vote, and I registered to vote in Ann Arbor. Because that's where I was at the time. And I figured I, to the degree that I might have any actual effect, it was more likely to be effective in Ann Arbor than in New York City.
Eric, you ready? Okay, my name is Joe Freeman.
Louder, Joe.
A little louder. You want that to pick up.
Okay. My name is Joe Freeman. I started off working with Scope in Newberry County, and I got shifted to Henry County, Alabama in early August. To this day, I don't know why, but I know Jose seems to have shifted people around in odd ways. By the time I got to Scope, I had been deeply involved in the civil rights movement for 2 years as a student in Berkeley. I'd been involved in politics of one sort or another most of my life. But when the civil rights movement exploded in 1963, those of us who were politically active at Berkeley jumped right in. I was arrested 3 times before I even went south. And indeed, in the middle of July, I had to go back to Berkeley to get sentenced and then come back again. because I had graduated in June, I basically intended to stay. So I was in the South for 16 months and working for SCLC for a year and a half, the last 2 months being in Chicago. I was arrested two more times, once in Birmingham and once in Grenada, Mississippi. The Birmingham arrest was not civil disobedience. It was retaliation because the Department of Justice had announced that they were sending federal examiners into the city. And the headlines were full of it, and I had courthouse duty the next day. And let's just say the gendarmes decided I was an appropriate retaliatory object. In August of 1966, when I was working in Grenada, Mississippi, the Jackson Daily News devoted two-thirds of an editorial page to me. The editorial was headlined, "Professional Agitator Hits All Major Trouble Spots." It had five photos, mostly from the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, one from Grenada. They had my Grenada mugshot, and one from the Meredith March. They had hair up, hair down, front, side. Anyone experienced working in the South knew exactly what was going on. The editorial didn't quite call me a communist. It just said I was joined communist organizations and worked for communist goals and was a friend of communists. And I suppose to make their point that I was a professional educator, except I was 25, I barely passed my 20th birthday. Jose took one look at that and said, "This thing makes you clan bait. I want you on the next bus out of here." So I was sent back to Atlanta, where they really didn't know quite what to do with me. And I flitted around for a while. I ended up working as Coretta Scott King's assistant for a few weeks. And then Jose was told to go to Chicago to start a voter registration project. So he said, "Okay, go to Chicago. I'll be there in a couple weeks." So my last 2 months at SCLC were in Chicago, where, frankly, the whole project was in the process of falling apart. So I sort of segued out of the movement. I had already decided that I wanted to organize women. So I was looking for women to organize. While I had an incipient feminist consciousness when I left Berkeley, working in the Southern movement enhanced it. It gave me ideas, it gave me analysis, it gave me all sorts of new perspectives. I could talk about that for hours, but we don't have hours, so I won't. The women's liberation movement was the child of the civil rights movement. I mean, I'm stating that as a fact, not an interpretation, it's not an opinion. If anyone else says differently, they just don't know the facts. But it was the bastard child of the civil rights movement, because the civil rights movement, frankly, did not want to claim it, really didn't like the ideas that we came up with. And maybe now they're beginning to accept the fact. But trust me, I've been to events 25 years ago at which, never mind.
Source subject.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't like it at all.
3 minutes.
Three.
You're finished.
I'm finished.
Okay, I'm Selena Kiesecker, and while I did not work in SCOPE, and I was working in working with migrants in Colorado, I was very much affected by this because of my now husband being in Madison, Florida. And when my family was, I'm a second generation, half Swede. My grandfather came over, he was sent back once to Sweden, and he came a stowaway for a second time and worked himself across the states digging ditches, because that's what dumb, strong Swedes did. As a part of that, I grew up in a family that was very much aware of people and different kinds of people. And in my childhood home, we had anybody who came through that was not a part of the community would end up in our home, eating, dancing, talking, organizing in different kinds of ways. And then when, since how it has affected me in some ways since, I've always been in organizing from a local sense, whether it was working with putting sports activities together in a community that where children was nice for them to be able to learn to play together rather than to fight together. So I became a soccer coach and a basketball coach, and I read a lot of materials about how one does such things and talk to different people. So that also had different peoples coming in and helping to do those kinds of jobs that I had no clue about which I was doing. At this point now, how it is affecting me, having lived in as mission personnel in Guatemala and working with people whose children were going to be coming north and answering questions about what is it like to go north, and then talking with people who came down from the States as we made arrangements for them to visit in the communities in which they visited, to say to them that really building a house here is okay, but when you get back home is where your real work starts. How are you going to interpret your feelings to your own community? It's easy to go someplace else, even if you are threatened with death, but when you do get back into your own community, are you fluid that you're just going to go back into the wave of regularity, or are you going to seek out those spots that where you are not comfortable, but where you can use the skills, the sensitivity that you have had? So that's my story for the moment. Thank you.
Did you say wait or go?
It's under your chair.
Oh, is it? So what do I do?
Okay. Thanks. Yep. Jason again. I was born in 1972, so I guess my influence would be that I was born out of this stuff, the work. My parents, I said in another breakout, broke up when I was about a year and a half, and both of them told me along the lines that it was post-traumatic stress, whatever you want to call it. They didn't really call it that. They said shock, whatever they went through, the pain from the movement, and even their own families, right? My mother was black, native, from Louisiana, Creole, Catholic raised, so not really into their native traditions. Their family wasn't into her being with the white man. His family wasn't into him. Mostly his family was against it for his safety. They thought he'd be hurt being married to this woman and, you know, going around with her. Anyway, long story short is I from their separation, I kind of like rebelled against the pacifistic ways that my father always sent me books about, talked when I visited him. And I got into like the macho male role, more like the Black Panther image, but turned out as a teenager, it became like a delinquent image. And I always tell people I took the long, hard way back to nonviolence. And now nonviolence is like one of my life purposes. I bring it into the juvenile halls. I bring it into all the work I do. It's like, you know, and I get the young people to say, like, even think of the fights that you've won. Did you really feel good after? And when they get down to the truth, it's like, no, they feel like they hurt someone. There's really no victory in it, you know? So, I don't know. I just thank all y'all because this is like golden to me to be here. You know, I remember going to Obama inauguration and coming back, and my mother had to watch it on TV, and she said she cried for 10 days because she thought she'd never see it. She just cried with joy for 10 days. She'd rewind it, watch it over, like pinch myself, is it real? And I got to see it, right? And I get to meet people that were there, you know? This is huge for me. I'm complete.
Thanks. I'm Ed Sankowski. I go back to 1945, so I'm like 70. I was thinking how to arrange this because it's primarily about scope, and I'll try to cut short the pre-scope aspects of this. I come from New York City. I'm a child of working class immigrant parents. They're from Eastern Europe. They were from Eastern Europe. I became a philosophy professor eventually. And I do remember back when I was in graduate school, major disruptions on the campus at my graduate school that involved the disciplining of African-American students and inequitable treatment, apparently, of them compared to others on campus. My primary interests are in ethics and political philosophy, so I focus a lot on that, and I'm interested in it not simply as an academic exercise, but also in terms of the relationship between theory and practice doing. So eventually, you know, I was working away at this kind of stuff. Let's see, when I got to the University of Oklahoma, just as a matter of job movement around the country, one interest, I felt when I got tenure especially, I felt more responsibility for the institution that I was at, and I thought there was a peculiar absence of blackness, especially in my local, my department, but also the university as a whole. So I worked hard to recruit someone, but to recruit someone under those circumstances where I had no institutional authority to do so, I was simply acting as a faculty member, I had to put pressure on, and people don't appreciate pressure. I noticed that it's hard to change a social system that's as backward and racist as the Oklahoma system is in many respects. So this guy got hired, actually, and he was brilliant. Contrary to the view that there are no candidates out there, there are very bright candidates out there. But I think some of my colleagues never forgave me, or they've always viewed me with suspicion, that sort of thing. Okay, that's me. At that point, there was a point when the dean at that point, it wasn't that bad a guy, said, well, take him around to visit various people. Let him visit Betty Harris. And Betty Harris eventually became my wife. She's African-American. She's there. And she was fairly frank with the candidate who was eventually to come to campus. I started to date her, and we did get married. I might add, after 6 years, because I'm a very deliberate guy. Okay, but we've been married for 22 years. She was not in scope. However, her parents participated in civil rights activities in Crawfordville, Georgia. She's from Georgia and Alabama. The family had also lived in Tuskegee, Alabama. Mm-hmm. So we're different types in that sense. We're from different parts of the country. We're rather similar in other respects in that we're both political people, and I think we've become increasingly political in an activist sense. Her parents were fired, actually, during that period for a variety of actions, and I think some people here are looking into that as part of the story, the overall pattern, you know, of what Scope was doing. You could
That's
tell me,
three.
What's that?
That's three.
3 minutes.
That's it. Okay.
At least for this round.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, do we want to take a second round? I will say something and then throw it out to you and see if anybody else shares my feeling.
Are you?
Oh, sorry, Kathy Lass, Southampton County, Virginia, home of Nat Dernis.
Are you? I think he's the I was not part of Scope. I heard that this was happening, so I wanted to come and love hearing these stories.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
When I was down south, out of, I think, naivete and maybe poor judgment, I got myself into some bad situations that I shouldn't have put myself into, totally innocently. The entire summer, I felt that the black person would come to my aid, that if I saw a black man and I was in an uncomfortable situation, I knew I was safe, basically. Mm-hmm. And that happened throughout the entire summer. There's another woman here who was with me, and I think she felt the same way. It's the only time in my life, frankly, that I really have ever felt that, that if I saw another black person, I knew it was going to be okay for me. And I don't know the contrast when I came back home has been dramatic. And I don't know if anybody else has had that experience. Yes, sir.
Ken Long, when after a year I was going to go into the Peace Corps after 65, so this was 66, I decided to visit my host family in Macon before us going to the training station for the Peace Corps. So I take the train, go cross country, I visit the family, and they say, hey, you know, Merle, one of the guys in your group stayed here and is going to college. In fact, he got engaged to a black woman and took her to the prom or the formal dance for the college, and he was his usual confrontive self. And I said, oh, yeah, give me a number. So I contacted Merle, and he said, oh, good, I want you to meet my fiancée. They're having a talent show down at a men's club. Or a men's club is sponsoring a talent show above a bar in a kind of a ballroom area. And so, okay, so we get the car, go down there, and we go up the rickety stairs to the top of the stairs, and there's some guys at the door kind of taking money or taking orders or something, because they had to pay for putting on the show and renting the room. And as they came in, they say, hey, you need, and they start talking to this guy. His name is Merle, my friend. And Merle says, ah, never mind. And he just blew him off and walked right by him. And I said, Merle, should we be doing that? Because I had been back in California, not being around black people. I was not, like you said, suddenly I wasn't comfortable with black people. When I was in Macon, Georgia, and living in black neighborhoods, living in black homes, everything was just hunky-dory. I was like, oh yeah, I am white, am I? But this time I had, that stuff had built back into me, that they were them and not us. A little bit, anyway. But so anyway, but Merle, of course, had none of that. He was comfortable as all hell. So we go over, we sit down at the table, you can just speak to the lady, and her friends, and we're talking, and then the guy from the doorway comes over and says, you better buy some beer, we got to pay for this operation. And Merle says, come on, man, I don't want to buy any beer. And I said, Merle, I think we should be buying some beer. Anyway, he just blew him off entirely. So the guy, suddenly his voice rises another octave, and he's really pissed. And then he goes, bam, and he hits Merle right in the face. Merle's glasses go flying, and I think, oh, lovely. Two white guys in the middle of all these black people, we're going to get totally screwed here. And so I'm thinking, well, we'll just go back to back. We'll try to edge toward the door. None of that happened. Everybody came running over to Merle's support. The guy who had hit him ran off the other direction. Hmm. And they're all saying, Merle, are you okay? Everything fine? And I just had to sit down. My legs were shaking. But it just showed you that the fear had built up in me, but of course he had no reason to fear, and so he's quite comfortable with the whole situation. So there is that, once you're out and not living among black people, or you're just living only in your own group, you do kind of build up this, some sort of antipathy or something. I don't know if that applies, but that's...
Well, that's okay.
Stories?
Well, I felt, I'm Ray Nelson, I felt some of the same discomfort after being among blacks all summer and in black churches and black community, back to mass meetings and stuff. It was really a strange feeling to go back home to an all white church, all white. It was maybe nervous because I didn't feel safe even in my own home church, places I'd grown up. There was a real feeling of this is not right. It's not safe.
Well, I was down south long, but it was very clear in Chicago. I had completely come to view whites as the enemy. And when I would walk along the street, even though no one knew me, I was in a white neighborhood. If I was in a white neighborhood, my anxiety level would go up a little bit. I'd get very cautious. I'd be looking all around me. I was like looking for the person who was going to come after me in the back of my head. I was lucky that after I left SCLC, which was like December, I linked up with something called the, what was the name of that thing? Oh, I wish Harry Boyd was here because he knows exactly what I'm talking about. Anyway, but the consequence of that is I ended up having a five-month subsidized job with the West Side Torch. Now, the Chicago's West Side is a black ghetto. The Torch was a newspaper that was trying to serve that black ghetto. I was basically being paid subsistence by the United Church of Christ through this organization whose name I'm blanking on to work for the West Side Torch, but only for 5 months. The editor of the Torch was another white woman. We worked out of the West Side organization, which was a black organization. But I was fortunate in that that particular combination allowed me to very slowly decompress. So I was in the black community, but not of the black community. Whereas for the year and a half, I had been completely enmeshed in the black community. But slowly, over a period of time, I stopped looking at white people as the enemy and being afraid to talk to them and sort of slowly reintegrated myself back into the white world. There was one time, though, in which I flipped back into that. This was very interesting because it shows how context triggers reactions. A couple years later, there was a black candidate for Congress in Chicago South Side, and I could look up and tell you who it was, but I honestly don't remember. But in the South Side District, and I worked for this person, I mean, I was a campaign volunteer, and the district was, I don't know the percentages, is heavily black, but not completely black. And not surprisingly, he sent the white volunteers into the white neighborhoods to canvass. But there was something about the fact that I was working for a black candidate that triggered the mindset I had had. So when I found myself walking door to door in these white neighborhoods, I was back to looking at whites as the enemy. The fear reaction that I had developed in the South came back. And it disappeared when I went back to headquarters. So there was something in my head that had associated black-white distinctions as being fear on the one hand and safety on the other. And even though I had gotten past that, it got triggered when I went back to working for a black candidate. And I found that really, really interesting. It gave me some insight into behavioral psychology and how things that we don't even think about trigger reactions on our part.
I guess. Let's see. I thought Dick Gregory had a wonderful piece not long ago. He's kind of been resurrected at 86. And it was about the fear reactions that people have as part of racist culture and, having to live with this. I'm sure we've all thought about that. I had no problems with it. I thought it was a fine piece, but I also thought it mostly required that you be able to decode and interpret what he was saying. And I'm not sure it would persuade those who are somehow on the other side, who are part of the problematic white culture that I think is certainly there. I'm not, I don't feel afraid of white people, but I think a lot of them are screwed up so far as race is concerned. I don't believe all of them are, and I'm not defensive about being white and being genuinely concerned about black rights and black flourishing. So I don't really have problems about that. Betty has affected me enormously, and she learned a great deal, of course, from her experience in the South growing up. She grew up in segregated schools. As I mentioned, her parents were activists. So that's the connection with this particular this particular conference. But we've both been in South Africa, for example. And oddly enough, when I was in South Africa, I thought it was kind of a toss-up whether that was worse or whether Oklahoma was worse. I'm serious about that. Because in some respects, the hypocrisy and hostility was worse in this country than it was in South Africa. That was at the time that there was a transition taking place to a putatively post-apartheid government. Both she and I, and she's influenced me enormously in this, have a kind of global perspective on racial issues. And so we agree with Du Bois that race was the problem of the 20th century. It continues to be a problem, or maybe the problem of the 21st century. It's certainly a huge problem. I'd like to know where we go from here, too.
When I first came back from Alabama, I had been fairly well prepared for some culture shock when I went from Wisconsin to the South. What I was not prepared for was the culture shock coming back and seeing what I had known all my life in a different light. For one thing, everybody white, and I lived in a white neighborhood in Wisconsin, everybody white looked unhealthy to me. It wasn't that I was afraid of them. It wasn't that I felt anxious. It didn't occur to me that I had the same unhealthy look. And about this time, the National Student Association was meeting in Madison, and I had been scheduled to speak about a project that I was involved in at the college that I went to, which is Alverno College. The project was working in migrant camps. It was a service project. It had no social change emphasis. And the people who came to that breakout session that I was part of pounced on that. But they pounced on it in very theoretical, philosophical, academic kinds of terms. And I was 10 days home from Bullock County, Alabama, and I didn't have their rhetoric. They sounded foreign to me in a way that was off-putting. And I, to this day, have some feelings of ill ease when I'm in an activist's group and somebody begins to talk very theoretically. I felt at the time, getting back to 1965, I felt at the time that the only place for me was on the front lines. That was where people spoke the language that I knew and thought about things the way that I thought about them. And that didn't exclude theorizing, but it wasn't that academic kind of smart-ass theorizing that I had heard from some students at that NSA conference. I guess that's all I want to say at this point.
I don't know, this may be leading us, I'm Ray Nelson, this may be leading us into another area. I think that this whole experience was the beginning of something that
tell your name.
Ray Nelson. And from matters directly concerned with voting rights and civil rights, I evolved into this dealing with matters related to education, the education system. And when I left teaching to make a living, I went to work in a steel mill. I was a recording secretary for my local for 20 some odd years. And I came to see labor justice as connected with both civil rights and education too. And now I've become convinced that all issues related to justice are interconnected. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that by dealing with one, we deal with all in some way or other. And somehow I think we perhaps, I feel we have to have to approach all of them and without neglecting any. The injustice to one is impairs all of us in a way that seems very real to me. It's not a theoretical issue. Yes.
Yeah.
Your name.
I'm Ed Sankowski again. I don't see theory at its best as something that's totally abstract. I mean, if you live with someone, you think about issues concerning race in a very different way. But I completely agree with you that the labor movement, including white working class people, ought to be, I don't know how to bring it about, united with black civil rights struggles, and it's much more likely to be effective if that's done. I'm not quite sure how to go about that. But being an educator, I think much more in terms of dealing with my everyday work, you know, so I focus a lot on that. One of my parapolitical activities has been like on the board of the ACLU in Oklahoma, which isn't that bad an organization. It's a little bit too limp for me in terms of being not far enough over towards the left. The ACLU national organization is interesting. They have a racial justice project, and I'm particularly interested in both ways, academically and as an ACLU member, in de-incarceration issues and mass criminalization and mass incarceration. It's a huge problem. You know, I think many of you would be familiar with this. So in where do we go next, I would say one of the things to do next would be to focus in that area. I think the ACLU was okay on that. The local ACLU, however, I thought was quite backward for quite a while, and I felt I had to push them a bit. And I don't know if it was just because of me, but they would do things like I'd appoint a committee, it would be a racial justice committee, and then the next year I'd be away for a while, and they'd say, it's a social justice committee. Suddenly race was being erased. But eventually what happens is these issues are there and they're so powerful in American society. They start surfacing and there are disorders. And then eventually you can't ignore the issue. So that's very palpable. It's not theoretical.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to monopolize it, but I think that's a...
I just want to ask a question and write Kathy last. And then we can go back to what you wanted to say. I find myself the last few years, and this is, I don't know how directly it is related to my scope activity. I've always been left wing, long story, for justice. But the older I get, the less patient I get with the statements, the idiotic statements that I hear people make. And I used to be able just to kind of let those roll off my back, and I find that it's harder for me to do that. I want to say, you ignorant ass, think about what you're saying. And I know that's not going to get me anywhere. I know that's not the right way to approach things, but I feel like I'm getting older, and if I don't say it now, when am I going to say it? I don't know if any of you have the same issues as you age.
Well, I think you have earned the privilege to say exactly what you want. I'm Ray Nelson, and you are entitled to say what you've got on your mind. What are they going to do to you? You have earned it. You've earned the right.
Thank you.
This is Margaret Roska again. I had pretty much the same reaction. Well, that's a alternative of what you can say, and if you choose that alternative at that time, maybe it does do some good to have that blindness come forward. But for the most part, I don't engage in one-on-one arguments when someone makes a statement, because I would rather devote my energies to group organizing, group actions, I'm from Wisconsin. Do you know what has happened in Wisconsin in the last 5 years? There's no end of groups that are functioning that if you don't have a lot of time, you can just go and join them for a day. The Solidarity Sing-Along continues to happen every weekday in the Madison Capitol. There, they have something like 1,200 consecutive weekday sing-alongs in the state capitol. There's the Overpass Light Brigade that holds up messages occasionally. Right now, there's a lot of organizing around schools because of privatization and the legislature recently enacted a law that sets up a non-elected commissioner who can take as many as 3 to 5 schools per year out of the Milwaukee Public School District and turn them over to private operators, as though changing who's in operating the school is a way of improving the educational outcome for students and bypassing the elected school board. And there are good people on the Milwaukee School Board. So the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association and a group called Schools and Communities United have been organizing a defense committee, in effect, for each school so that when the commissioner comes and says, we're taking over this school, there will be enough people who will circle the school and say, no, you're not. And I would rather give my energy to an action like that than arguing with my nephew's wife, who says ridiculous things. It's hard.
I'm Selena Kiesecker. One of the things that I'm involved in at this moment is visiting and writing letters to persons who are in detention. And right now at the center where we are visiting in Eloy, Arizona, there are a number of persons from Africa that have come for asylum for varieties of reasons. And they've heard about black and white relations within the states and are wondering about it. And as they relate to some of the correctional officers, some of their presuppositions are worked out and others are not. And one of the just interesting comments that several persons, we're right now working with people from 6 different nations, and they say to Joe and myself, why aren't you, or my goodness, you're not like the other whites that we meet here. That, what happened to you that you have a broader perspective as it is for who we are because of how they have been received as they have come from Brazil up through to Tijuana to get credible fear. And as they've related to white people, that it hasn't often been that they've been received as a person. So that's been a very interesting experience for us. And for us, it sort of jars us into thinking about what kind of a responsibility we have, that at every moment we are a role model. And one of the things that we were raised with in farm country was don't get in a pissing fight with a skunk. And oftentimes, I get so irritated with some things that I really have to bite my tongue so that that doesn't happen.
I'll remember that.
What was your name?
Ed.
Ed said something about where do we go
and
from.
And your name again?
I'm Jason again. About where we go from here, where I see the next fight. I actually see the next fight is classism. Mm-hmm. And I think that what you guys did was phenomenal because nowadays our young people aren't afraid to date within the racial lines like you might have been raised by your parents and grandparents. The young people are fearless when it comes to that. It's like they like somebody, they're interested. They don't care if they came from another country, what color, what anything. But what happens in the class stuff is that racism comes back to the surface because that's what they use against. It's like they'll take the poor white fears and the poor black fears and the poor Latino fears and pit them all against each other. Even the poor Asian fears, poor Middle Eastern fears, they pit them all against each other. And that raises the thing that you guys all try to get rid of back to the surface. And that's just where I see the struggle. It's why I do poverty advocacy, because it's like, you know, going in those institutions, the institutions actually like when the races are against each other, because they're easier to control. And I go in there and I go, well, see, I haven't had the luck to be able to pick a side, right? I've always been white, black, native. My wife happens to be Asian and white. My kids are like more multicultural than me. They'll have less of a choice of where to fit in. And it's made me love all people. And these kids are like, what? You know, how do you do? But anyway, that's just what I wanted. When you said what's next, I think the class thing is the next deal, because the greedy are getting just a little greedier, and they're causing the ones that have less to follow that mentality because they have less, so that they want to hold on to it, right? Anyway, I'm complete.
This is Ed Sikorski. I'm actually, without being doctrinaire about it, I accept Marx's view that economics is fundamental, and that I don't care who thinks you're a communist if you say this. There are actually bourgeois economists who will say the same thing. So, I think that's really basic. And I don't know if we don't need to get into really a general theoretical question about whether a race is something irreducible, you know, but a lot of racism, I think, does have economic roots, and it's valuable. Maybe there's some that's left over, just something crazy about people's psychology. The mass, I don't want to make the mass incarceration thing a hobby horse, but that seems to be, a manifestation of a refusal to integrate people into the workforce, among other things. And increasingly with private corporations running prisons, there's a vested interest. People know this, I guess. Everybody, you're thinking about, what the hell is this? So they have a vested interest in lobbying with legislators who are corrupt. And they have guarantees in my state, for example, number of beds in prisons. You get paid for that, whether you have people there or not. This is an insane system. For some reason, there are elements on the right now who are also thinking, oh, it's too expensive, or something like that. And that remains to be seen why that's happening. But we got to work it. I think that's one area to work at. And you do it with different tactics. You don't just talk about it one-on-one. You know, for example, you sue.
Right.
That's one thing to do. Of course, the courts are corrupt, but sometimes you catch an honest judge, or the situation is such you can actually litigate, and we've done that sometimes.
One of those... one second.
Tom Rothschild. I'm not sure I would say... sorry. I'm not sure I would say that the courts are corrupt. I would say that the law is written in such a way as to sustain the system, so that an honest judge has no choice but to say, to support what exists, and that to get at the root of it, you have to go someplace other than the courts. That doesn't mean you don't go to court, but you have to understand that you have to be able to get at the law itself, because you can't ask the judge to do something that the law doesn't allow. Another thing that I would say is that the prison question, another piece of it is that in many states it becomes a source of cheap labor.
Absolutely.
It makes much more... Yeah. quote-unquote, economic sense to send somebody to prison, pay the company to run the prison, and pay the person 75 cents an hour than to have them outside and have them have to get a job the way that somebody would have to pay them $15 an hour or even $8 an hour.
And medical.
And, well, the medical they get in prison anyway. It may not be the same quality, it may cost less, but it's one of the costs of running a prison system. Thank you. Let's remember that Marxism is not about just economics being behind things, but a particular analysis of class and class fights and struggles and however you want to put it.
Right.
My American history professor said, actually underneath, every honest, real historian is a Marxist. Mm-hmm. 20 years later, he claimed, oh, I was just trying to entice the students
in high school
to get them thinking. Right. But in fact, I'm quite sure he believed it, and I think for good reason. That doesn't mean that Marxism is necessarily the only analysis of total society, but
I agree. Yeah.
I just want to put that thought in since you brought up the subject.
Mm-hmm. Ray, did you?
Actually, let me, rather than going around and around and around, I want to come back to what I'm doing now with indigenous peoples, because it seems to me that the two pillars that this country is built on economically, one is slavery, and the other is land taken from indigenous peoples, and we have tended to ignore the second, and I think that our society is still not willing to acknowledge the deliberate policy of genocide that lasted for 500 years. And if you don't even acknowledge that, again, everything is related to everything else. So that's part of why I'm there, and I guess to some extent it grew out of this work and other things. And the other thing that draws me to it is the importance of the land and protecting the land, which is an essential part of virtually every indigenous culture, certainly in this continent, however you name it. And so, because everything is related to everything else, I find this a very good place to start unraveling these things and bringing them forward, because in fact that same law that led to genocide is still fundamental Indian law, quote unquote. That's what we call that field of law. So with that, I will pass it on.
Hello, I guess I should say something once during this conference.
You gotta tell us who you are.
I'm Derek Gilliard, so I am 10 years, I'm a decade after you scope folk, and I'm probably just another piece of your legacy. I did not grow up in the rural South, although I was born here. My training and background is as a journalist. I was commissioned by Time to cover Jesse's first run for president. Spent 10 years with USA Today, so I had that background. In 1995, I went to work for Joseph Lowery in the SCLC as his communications director. So we dealt with the burning of the black churches, economic empowerment, all the, you know, many of the things that you all know about. So, but during my time there, it was just imparted on me that the stories of you all, the people whose lives have been forever changed because of your experience in the civil rights movement, or whether you were in towns and communities that the movement went to. So that's my work, is on focusing on the, I call them the unsung heroes and sheroes who were connected with Dr. King. So my first book, I'm now working on the Lowery biography, and several of the scope people are some of the people that I profile. So, and what do I do now? I'm at an inner city church that's about a block from two blocks from the largest heroin distribution point in the southeast. Six blocks directly down the street the other way is the world headquarters of Coca-Cola. So,
is there a difference?
Can you believe it? And so it's that kind of work. I know one family in that community where there's a mother and a father in the house, and most people, there's somebody that's in jail for turning tricks, selling drugs, you name it. White kids come into that community to buy drugs because they don't want to buy them in there where they're from, and they're found dead in their car the next day. Nobody killed them, but they've OD'd. So it's a great deal of work, and we're involved with the after-school program to try to get these kids ready to have a better life.
What city?
Right here in Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah, right here in Atlanta. And I should say this. An extension of what I do, interestingly enough, I had a son that started having seizures. So at the SCLC, I had insurance and my wife and my children didn't. So I had to come out of the cold and get a real job because I couldn't afford his medicine. So for the last, 17 years, I've worked for a political appointee. And the principal thing that she's responsible for now is implementing, quote unquote, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, in the 8 southeastern states. So I still think it's very much a ministry to the least of these and an empowering kind of work.
Oh, all right. All right, Shelby, we'll let you pass, but I don't know.
I think she tried to say we were over.
Yeah.
I think
they want to be. So are we done?
Yeah, I think she was trying to bring us back to
it. Gotcha.